Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Divorce rates in the U.S. have been on the decline in recent years, but within those separations, research out of UW-Madison showed a shift in the placement of children from those divorces. Back in the 1980s, just 2% of divorces in Wisconsin resulted in equal joint custody of children. The vast majority of divorces had one parent gain sole custody, maybe with visitation rights. Jump ahead to the 2010s, that number jumped up about a third of divorces leading to joint custody. Other studies have shown similar trends nationwide. But a lot of our social safety net and child support systems are still designed with one household in mind. Our next guest researches family characteristics and public policy. He's here to help us learn more about how these custody systems work and how they could be improved. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or a loved one gone through a child custody split? What was that experience like? What do you think of the current child support system? And if you're in a family with joint and equal custody, has that created difficulties in dealing with things like bureaucracy at any level? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Quentin Reiser is an assistant professor of human development and family studies at UW-Madison. Quentin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
And thank you for having me.
Quentin, when a couple is getting divorced or a non-married couple with kids is splitting up, what are the factors that go into determining custody placement of children?
Yeah, so I always sort of begin from this premise that courts and families sometimes make decisions around where a child should be placed in the event of a divorce or a separation. And there are a lot of factors. One you can imagine is how well off the family is. So a lot of times when we think about this phenomenon of shared care increasing over time, and you cited the statistic that talked about equal care, but when we talk, when we think about joint physical custody, whether it be symmetric, which is roughly 50-50, or asymmetric, where both parents have at least 25% of their time with the child, but it's some sort of variation on 50-50, maybe 45-55, that has increased from roughly 12.5% to roughly a third, as you said. And now, if we look at those data, most recent data show that over half of custody arrangements in the U.S. are shared. And so it's true that when we think about shared custody, there's this selection effect where traditionally more affluent, more highly educated parents selected into this arrangement. And one of the reasons that you can think that might be true is because this arrangement, the shared care arrangement, is a costly arrangement. You can think about fixed costs such as housing. If the child's going to have a bedroom in parent A and parent B's home, well, then that duplicates the cost, essentially. There's actually data from Australia that estimates that a shared care child is roughly 70% of a child in each home. And so now you have like 1.5 children with the same level of income, presumably, for both parents. So income is one factor that is a consideration when parents are opting for one custody arrangement or the other. One important dimension that I think about in my research is the extent to which the parents can cooperate. I think custody type notwithstanding, that cooperation or conflict is critical in shaping developmental outcomes, and we can get a bit more into that later. So it's really the things that come up immediately when you ask that is, you know, how well off is the family? Are they a family of means? And how well do the co-parents get along, essentially?
Well, that's interesting because that means, in effect, there's a built-in inequity on that. If you have, let's suppose, a lower-income couple who do get along and would love to have equal custody of their kids, there might just straight up be a financial impossibility. They couldn't afford together to maintain two households big enough to support those kids.
Certainly. And so you can and I think a lot of it, what we would point to is those fixed costs like housing. I mean, certainly there are time dependent costs such as food or maybe utilities, depending upon how much water, I guess, or what have you, that the child is using when they're staying in your home. But lower income families would often struggle at times to maintain one household. And so when you break into two households and you lose sort of these economies of scale, it becomes much more difficult to sustain that arrangement. And I think it's also important to point out that lower income families are not really always what we're talking about when we conduct these studies on joint physical custody. And that's mainly because lower income families are more likely to cohabitate than to marry. And so when we're thinking about the cohort of families that have been divorced, I mean, this is already of the baseline of families that have children, sort of a more socioeconomically advantaged group compared to the counterparts who cohabitate. And so always, too, it's important to kind of note that while there's this sort of positive selection, as I've suggested, into shared care relative to sole care, such that those that enter into the shared care arrangement typically have higher incomes and are more educated, there's actually a negative selection into divorce, right? Such that those who divorce have lower incomes and are commonly less educated than their counterparts who remain in stable marriages. And so it's a really complex dynamic to study these phenomenon of divorcing and separating parents and how children should fare in each of these arrangements when you think about all of the possibilities. So it's something that, you know, that we all try to disentangle.
Talking to Quentin Reiser, Assistant Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at UW-Madison, about joint custody of children, how it works differently, maybe at different income levels in our country. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Quentin, I wonder, with families who are not married, you know, cohabiting, maybe raising kids, when they separate, they're not married, so they don't get divorced. Are there cases where, hey, we're just figuring out our child raising system without going to the courts and maybe without researchers being able to research it?
Well, that is true, yes. But it's also true among shared care families. It's true in some data. We worked on a study. This was actually an international comparative study contrasting data from Wisconsin, which represented the U.S. in this case, and Finland. And we assessed the extent to which shared care families, relative to sole care families, shared an array of expenses. And we looked at, like, expenses such as hobbies and health insurance and a series of expenses, and asking the question, do shared care families share expenses? But a part of that study that we assessed was, are shared care families more likely or less likely to have a formal child support agreement? Or do they sort of, as you suggested about maybe lower income families that are cohabitating, handle things among themselves? And it's true that shared care families, as we found, are more likely to kind of handle things among themselves. And when you think about lower income families and potentially parent A or parent B attempting to support the child or attempting to establish a level of time with the child, there is also some of that we see. That's not something that empirically I've investigated, but there are others that have that suggest that, yes, sometimes it is more arm's length than it is, let's get the courts involved in determining legal and physical custody arrangement.
We're talking to UW-Madison Human Development and Family Studies Professor Quentin Reiser about an increase in joint child custody, how it fits into child support and other systems. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Have you dealt with this in your life? Did you come up with an amicable shared custody arrangement with the help of courts or without? Join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Quentin Reiser, Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at UW-Madison, looking at how our social safety net systems work for children in different custody arrangements after their parents separate. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Brian is with us in Rice Lake. Brian, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I just wanted to share my experience 5 years ago during my divorce. I filed for placement of my daughter, and I also filed for child support. And what I found in Barron County here where I live is that when I filled out the forms, I really couldn't. We had to audit the edit the forms so that we had to scratch out wife, mother, because there was nowhere for male husband, you know, father to put his name on the form when we submitted it. And I also felt when I was in court, I had an experience with the judge and said, hey, sure is really great, you know, that a man wants to have his child, and he applauded me, and then he further insulted me by saying, and it sure is great that a husband or a man would want to have his daughter. And it really hurt my feelings.
Brian, I'm sorry to hear that. Thank you for sharing that experience. Quentin, as I understand in American history, there was early on a presumption that the father would get custody, then for a long period, the mother. And Brian, in very recent history, facing that presumption, even on the forms he had to fill out.
Right. And that is so true. And a lot of what we track the trends in the uptick of shared custody to is, I don't think Brian's example necessarily highlights this, but a move and a change in sort of social and legal perspectives, courts preferring joint custody for a long time. Wisconsin has been sort of more progressive than the nation in pursuing this sort of joint physical custody as a presumption. And it's kind of dovetailed with a cultural shift that recognizes the import of father involvement in child rearing, and a push for, you know, more balanced roles after divorce. And that's you sort of in line with what some of our sort of EU counterparts have done for quite some time in thinking about sort of the mother and the father as having sort of more equivalent roles to be earners or laborers, if you will, and carers, both responsible for bringing income into the home and both responsible for caring for the child, sort of a more egalitarian perspective. And so I think the trend suggests that there will come a time, hopefully soon, where that is not the interaction that fathers have with the system, and that you're not congratulated for doing what you feel you ought to do to care for your child, for sure. But I think I've interacted with a lot of fathers who echo your sentiments, and I think that's something that should be hopefully, you know, phased out based on the data that we see and the trends and the commonality of fathers like you who really want to care for their children.
Thanks a lot for that. Thanks a lot for that call, Brian. Aaron joins us now in Milwaukee. Aaron, hi.
Hi there. I'm just wondering, so as the stats show that your guest is referencing, as sort of this whole family court system moves toward the presumption of joint custody being in the best interest of kids, I'm wondering if your guest has any ideas on special considerations in cases of domestic violence. So particularly when you hear from survivors about being in really unsafe custody arrangements where they're sharing custody with an abusive ex-partner, and even in cases in which there are criminal convictions against the other parent, I think when one parent brings up a legitimate concern about violence or abuse or safety, they are often viewed by the family court system as high conflict or told in an explicit way that they should not be bringing these concerns up. Just wondering what your guest had to say on that issue.
Aaron, thanks. An important point, Quentin. How does domestic violence figure into these decisions?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And a lot of times when we write about these issues, we write, you know, shared care is the presumption. And, you know, courts would lean in that direction, except in the cases would be the hope of domestic violence, or except in the case where parents A or parent B, for whatever reason, weren't going to be able to interact with their child or the associated parent in a sort of more reasonable way. And so I think, like I said, parental conflict is, and that's not domestic violence per se, but parental conflict is such an important dimension. And so insofar as a parent has demonstrated a level of abuse or violence, I mean, you could imagine that would impact your level of agreement on various issues. I would say that is a situation where the recommendations should lean in the direction of a sole custody arrangement wherein parent A or parent B, the custodial parent, you know, cared for the child at least 75% of the time.
Aaron,
so I think there are certain cases where sole custody makes a lot of sense. And we can talk, you know, there are advantages and disadvantages to both, mm-hmm. even outside of looking at domestic violence cases. And you know, the literature is actually quite mixed as to what type of custody arrangement lends to, you know, improvements in outcomes. Anyway, so there's a lot to unpack that we can unpack.
Aaron, thanks a lot for that call. Just in our last minute or so, Quentin, I wanted to ask about, we saw some of you and your colleagues' work referenced in an Atlantic article that said, that pointed out, you know, the data you have, the increase in joint custody, but the rest of the world, the rest of our system not keeping up, and the idea that, you know, the schools want to deal with one address, and child support and public assistance programs want to deal with one address. Just briefly, our system's keeping up with this increase in joint custody.
The short answer is no. They're not keeping up with this. So when you look at most cross-national or within country data sets, when you look at, you know, OECD data or census data, a lot of times when we're tracking children, we're sort of allocating them to one home. Like, what home is the residence of this child? There's one. So in a shared custody arrangement, you can imagine if it's an equal sort of split care, that it would stand to reason that maybe this child should be, you know, 50% of this home for the sake of, you know, taxes, for the sake of economic supports, child maintenance, and 50% in this home. But our systems currently allow for a child to be in one place at one time. And you can think of all of the sort of negative implications for one parent or the other parent when you can only sort of count the child in one place in a given time frame. And so I think it, you can imagine the administrative burden and the sort of complex calculus that would come along with sort of splitting a child between homes sort of proportionally. But I think it's sort of necessary to ensure that parents have, you know, the supports they need in order to rear children. And kind of briefly here.
Just a few moments left.
Okay. Yeah. And so, like, when you think about custodial parents, they have access to multiple supports. You know, they have access to child tax credits and earned income tax credits and WIC and TANF and child support enforcement services, SNAP. And when you look at non-custodial parents, they generally don't have access to much. They're honestly treated by our systems as non-parents.
And that's where we'll leave it. Thanks to Quentin Reiser with UW-Madison's Department of Human Development and Family Studies, looking at an increase in children under joint parental custody. More than 90% of Wisconsin fire departments are staffed partially or entirely by volunteers, but for the last three decades, the number of volunteer firefighters around the country has been declining. In recent years, the state's fire departments and technical colleges have turned to high school students with the hope that training teens early on will lead to a lifelong interest in the field. Hope Kerwin talked with some of the students who hope to be the next generation of firefighters.
Jaden Matheson is a senior at Onalaska High School. For much of her life, her dad has been a firefighter.
Like, I hear about the stories that he goes through, and I think they're so cool, and I hear about all the lives he saved.
Matheson wants to pursue her own career in firefighting, and if all goes well, she'll take the state certification exams for firefighters and emergency medical responders before she even graduates in the spring. She's enrolled in the Youth Firefighter Training Program through Western Technical College and the Onalaska Fire Department. High school students from around the region spend the first part of their school day attending class at the city's fire station. Matheson says her friends at school think she's crazy for wanting to be a firefighter, but she's ready to get started.
I sit on TikTok and I watch all the firefighting videos and I'm like, ooh, that looks really fun. Like, the adrenaline rush, I really want to go into that.
On a cold morning at the end of October, Matheson and her classmates are finally ready to face a real fire for the first time. Instructors from the technical college walk them through the burn tower, a collection of steel shipping containers that create a multi-story training course. Then the students crowd into one of the rooms and turn on their air tanks as the practice fire is lit. They take off a glove for a moment to feel the heat from the blaze. And an instructor talks them through the different stages of the fire as smoke fills the room.
You see what I'm saying? Want the fog in the headlights? I can't see nothing. I can't see you guys. What stage are we at?
Matheson and her classmate Rhett Stensley from Westby Area High School say the experience is both exciting and daunting.
It was kind of scary at first.
Nerve-wracking, not being able to see your hand. right in front of your face. I mean,
because the smoke buildup, it's just crazy because you can't see anything.
Very exciting, very exciting.
Tyler Ludeking from Western Technical College says the live fire training is an important step for the students, allowing them to put into practice what they've learned in class. And getting the experience while still in high school gives them the opportunity to see if their interest in firefighting holds up under the realities of the job.
They're really able to confirm that they do have an interest in fire, or they're able to confirm that maybe they don't anymore, but they still want to go into other areas in public safety.
Ludeking says interest in the youth program has grown over the last 3 years, both from students and fire departments who are hoping to one day recruit the teens in their area. He says the hope is that even students who pursue another career path will still put their training to use.
I think about students who are going to two-year technical or four-year college, for them to be able to say, hey, at the same time, I'm going to be maybe a volunteer firefighter in my off time, you know, that's a really good career opportunity for them.
But even if the teens stick with firefighting after graduation, not all of them want to staff Wisconsin communities. Stensley is one of them.
I want to do wildland firefighting to begin with and then eventually make my way to a department, some city, I'm hoping, get out of the Midwest a little bit.
Stensley says he hadn't thought about a career in firefighting until someone referred him to the youth program. He says the tight bond shared with his classmates has been the best part of the class, and he's found a sense of purpose in the work.
Spread positivity, help people on their worst days. I mean, that's why I'm doing this.
After going through the day's training, Matheson still has the same excitement about becoming a firefighter, even while acknowledging that facing a real fire is intimidating. She knows that this is a tough field.
You're going to see all the traumatic situations and, like, car accidents, babies and animals and just, like, older people, and I feel like that's going to be the most difficult.
She's one of the students who plans to stay in the state and is already looking at fire departments in northern Wisconsin, where she can work full-time after going through Western's Associates Program. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. President Biden visited Milwaukee yesterday as part of a push to engage black voters amid tough polling numbers. Here's Biden speaking to the Wisconsin Black Chamber of Commerce on Wednesday.
Across the country, wages for workers are up. Black wealth is up 60% since the pandemic. So many of you, look, and by the way, I mean this sincere from the bottom of my heart, we're just getting started.
Biden touched on economic policies, such as a push to extend pandemic-era child tax credits. Biden described his policy as a hard break from what he called trickle-down economics of past Republican administrations. The president's visit came in an economy that looks pretty good to economists, but not so good to everyday people, with about half of Americans rating the economy as poor in recent polls. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What does the national economy look like to you? What does your household economy look like today? What's the most important thing when you look at economic news to you? And do you have thoughts on the Biden administration's economic policies? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Kevin Smith is an assistant professor of economics at Beloit College. Kevin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. I'm happy to be here.
Let's start off a big picture, Kevin. I want to get your assessment of the health of the economy right now. We see the Dow hitting records lately, dipped down a bit from a record. Unemployment numbers in the 3-4% range. Inflation have been high, dipping down now. Your thoughts on the big picture?
So the big picture right now is that the U.S. economy is pretty strong if you just look at the numbers, right? So unemployment's at 3.7%. Inflation now, the latest reading is at 3.1%, right? Way down from the peak last June of around 9.1%. So if you just look at the numbers, the economy is doing pretty well. And the consensus amongst economists is the economy is doing pretty well. Then why is there this like disconnect between the economic numbers and what people feel? And the reason is because I think a lot of people are just still recovering from the pandemic. I think the last 3 years have been very rough on people. And then you go straight from a pandemic into incredibly high rates of inflation, the highest that the country's experienced in 50 years. I think that kind of takes a toll on people. So that's what I would say, the big picture. Economy, the numbers are looking really good. But for the average person, they made us not be feeling it.
I just earlier today saw a survey commissioned by The Atlantic. They asked people about their thoughts on the state of the economy. For the people who didn't like it, a lot of them said the problem was groceries. And here, I'm going to quote, when we asked what people had in mind when they reported that their personal finances were getting worse, 81% chose groceries. Now, I'm the grocery shopper in our family. I could definitely understand that. This is something you're faced with every day, a vital thing, especially if you're lower income, a big percentage of your income. How much of that do you think factors into our perception of the economy?
I think that factors in a big way because it's noticeable, right? Because you go and you buy groceries every week and you're like, whoa, I wasn't paying this in 2019. And so I think people internalize that. And not only that is that when you go and you talk to people within your network, all everyone's talking about, oh, prices of things have just gone. Eggs have gone up. Meat's gone up. All of these things have gone up. So a lot of times people will internalize that because that is real, right? Since 2019, a lot of those basic food items have gone up around 15 to 20%. Now, in the last 12 months, some of those things have started to come back down. But to the average consumer who goes out and purchases things, they still see it. And so I think that really impacts people's perceptions.
Talking to Kevin Smith, economist at Beloit College, looking at the state of the economy after President Biden visited Milwaukee, focused on economic issues. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Doug is with us in Portage. Doug, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a comment, not a question. And my comment is that as a retired person living on a fixed income, and watching the economy and watching what I have to pay for, I think the economy is doing remarkably well. It's better than any place else in the world right now. And the people, do I shop the exact same way I did 3 years ago? No, I now make different choices. But I've always, on the time span of 5 years, have had to make different choices as some things go up and some things go down. But the big comment I wanted to say was the people I know who complain about the economy, I say, what don't you like? And they say, Trump tells me it's bad. And that's all I can say.
Doug, thanks a lot for the call. Kevin, on that perception of the issue, there's definitely a partisan lens, and I think it could go both ways. If you're a devout Republican and there's a Democrat in the White House, you think they're handling the economy bad, flip the labels and people do the same thing. What do you think?
Yep. No, and there's been a lot of research showing this, especially in, say, the last 20 years, whenever the party that you don't support gets into power, perception of the economy tanks. Because, again, people see these things through a partisan lens. And many times it's because everyone's media environment has become so heavily siloed that good economic news or bad economic news that is against your particular political persuasion just never gets through, right? Or if it gets through, it gets kind of warped to say, oh, good economic news is really not that good, or bad economic news is really not that bad. But in an objective sense, everything the caller just said is correct. America is doing better than a lot of its peer countries. In fact, it's doing better than all of its peer countries, actually, in terms of, when you look at economic growth, when you look at in terms of how they've handled, how the Biden administration handled inflation. I mean, America is doing very well, but there is this disconnect that is political. But I think even people who'd say they're not very political would also say, hey, I don't feel like the economy is good.
Thanks for that call, Doug. Kevin, I wanted to ask about a specific policy item President Biden brought up in Milwaukee yesterday, the child tax credit. Now, we had an expansion of it in the early days of COVID, the thought, we need some money out there for people. It stuck around for a while. People have pointed toward that as cutting the poverty rate, especially for black children. It expired with the pandemic. What do you see as the potential impact of looking at that and bringing it back in some form?
So the child tax credit is a massive policy. And so a little bit of background here. The child tax credit has existed for many years, but in 2021 with the American Rescue Plan, the Biden administration really expanded it significantly and actually allowed families to get checks every month based on the number of children that they had and the age of their child, as well as what income bracket they fell into. And research show that within just that period of time, it cut child poverty for all children in half and cut child poverty for Black and Hispanic children by more than that. The issue was is that it's a very expensive policy. To make it permanent, I believe the figures from the CBO was it would be almost $1 trillion to make that permanent. And so it ended up not getting expanded. I believe that it is a policy that is key, especially with how expensive it is to raise a child in the U.S. And I think that if given the opportunity, I think the Biden administration would find a way to continue it. But I think there may need to be some tinkering with it. Senator Mitt Romney in 2021 tried to do kind of a compromised version with it, which kind of lowered the amount that families got and also lowered the threshold that families could get the money. And so I think there can be some tinkering along the edges to try to make it more affordable. But I think expanding the child tax credit, especially making it permanent, would have an immense impact, especially on Black families. And the last point I want to make on this is that a lot of times when we talk about wealth and income in the U.S., I don't think a lot of people realize just the gap. The typical African-American family has only around a third of the wealth of the typical white family. And so a policy like the child tax credit would change millions of people's lives.
Kevin Smith is with us, assistant professor of economics at Beloit College. He's talking to us about President Biden's visit yesterday to Milwaukee and the state of the U.S. economy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Were you affected by that change in pandemic-era child tax credits? Do you want to see it make a comeback as the president is proposing? How has inflation affected you over the past few years? Is the U.S. economy doing well from where you're sitting? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Kevin Smith, assistant professor of economics at Beloit College, about the state of the economy after President Biden focused on economic issues in a visit to Milwaukee yesterday. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Robert is with us now in Viroqua. Hi, Robert.
Hey, Robert. Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it. I just wanted to comment on one of your last callers who said he was on a fixed income and that it's better than it's ever been. I'd like to know what planet he's living on because we're on a fixed income and I don't see that at all. And I see the problem with fuel and oil. Everything that gets transported to and from stores has gone up. Gasoline has gone up. Truckers are spending more money on gasoline than ever, and that affects the cost of not just food, but products, any kind of product that you want to buy, hardware, furniture. That cost has gone up, I think, you know, at least 15, 20, 25%, and that's not good.
Robert, gotcha. Thanks a lot for that call. Kevin, Robert feeling a lot of different costs on his fixed income and pointing toward, I remember talking about this in the early days of high inflation, gas prices. Well, we move a lot of things by things powered by gas, and that had an effect on the rest of the economy.
No, and I understand Robert's point of view, because I think especially when you're on a fixed income, it price changes, you feel them, right? You feel them. And so you have to figure out ways to like leap through it. In terms of the point about gas, that is a major input, and prices do tend to follow the changes in global oil markets. What I will say though, in the last few weeks, what we have seen is that gas prices have fallen significantly, right? So it used to cost me around $45 to fill up my time, because now it costs me about $30, right? So we do see these prices coming down over time. But I think for a lot of people, again, it's that sticker shock, right? It's that sense that a few years ago, these things did not feel like they cost this much, and why am I paying this? And so even though we're starting to see prices, so like the most prominent one would be gas prices, come down, for a lot of people, it's still the sense that like, oh, but then why is it still so expensive to buy even like the basic necessities?
Thanks again for that call, Robert. Rick is with us now in Monona. Rick, hi.
Hi. I know that a lot of people want to lay the problems today, the economic problems, at Biden's feet, but isn't the reality that this came out of COVID and COVID created like the perfect storm in the economy? There's a when we came out of it, there was excessive demand. There were people that had done nothing for 3 years except store up money in their bank accounts. And the gas prices shot through the roof, and the Federal Reserve really hadn't done its job to monitor that very well.
Rick, thanks a lot for the call. Kevin, either with the current post-COVID situation or in general, how much control does a president have? How much credit do they get for good stuff? How much blame should they get for the bad stuff?
I think it's hard because there'll always be a feeling that the buck stops with the president. But in a fair assessment, the president does not have perfect control over the economy. Their actions and the policies that they support can push the economy in a specific direction. In terms of blaming President Biden, I think that there is a kind of broad debate within economics about Biden's public policy, particularly when he first entered office. So you know, the caller was exactly right. During COVID, people basically sat a huge number of people weren't able to spend a lot of the money that they had accumulated, so they started to dissave and started to go on trips, started to buy things, and demand skyrocketed. And so that led to a lot of shortages, and add with the supply chain issues that were occurring at that time as well, caused massive increases in prices. This is why the inflation that we've all experienced in the last few years was not just siloed in America. It was a global phenomenon. So in that part, that is out of the president's hands. But where economists kind of disagree in terms of Biden's impact is when it comes to things like the American Rescue Plan, spending $2 trillion when he first entered office. Many economists say that was too much, especially since there was really no offsets with the American Rescue Plan. When you spend $2 trillion on top of people having $3 trillion, $4 trillion in savings, that is a recipe for increased inflation. So that's the general argument. My point of view is that I think it's kind of unknowable, because I think the administration came into a pretty bad situation and looked to try to do the best that they could. But I know this will be something that will be debated for the next 20, 30 years.
Thanks a lot for that call, Rick. We're talking about the state of the economy after President Biden's visit to Milwaukee. Kevin Smith stays with us, economist at Beloit College. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Nancy is with us now in Appleton. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I think, you know, we all have to understand the economy has always been difficult for some people. And it's something that I don't think any president alone is to blame for. I think there's some things that truly are systemic in our society and in our economic system, and they need to be looked at. But I think people also need to look at experts, or at least like your guest today, who has studied this. There's a lot of complicated things, I would think, that go into the economy. And currently, right now, yes, groceries are expensive, but gas has come down. And several years ago, we went on a trip, and I kept commenting, this is the most expensive time, because it was over $4 a gallon back then for gas at that time. Mm-hmm. I think what's hurting a lot of people are what they notice is interest rates now for people who are first-time homebuyers. But they've really been used to, I think, a low rate when we bought our first house. Granted, it was not as expensive, but it was a 12% interest rate back in 1980. And so, and we're on a fixed income too, and somehow, you know, we were savers, so we managed. Manage fine right now, and
I'm going to cut in because we don't have a ton of time. You've given us a lot to talk about. Okay. First of all, something that Kevin, you actually say on your Beloit College website, you love working with your students to help them understand how economic trends affect their lives. For someone like Nancy, who's saying, "Hey, let's look at good information," what do you tell people to look at? You know, lay people who aren't trained economists, to understand the economy.
What I tell them is always look at any kind of data within context, right? And so this is what I teach my students, and this is what I will say to anybody. And I love Nancy's questions because a lot of what she was saying gets to the root cause of it, right? If you're a young person trying to buy a home, you probably don't think the economy is great because of high interest rates on mortgages. Even though mortgage rates have just started to come down, you're looking at the market and you're like, oh, this is awful, right? And so but what happens is that you have to put it within context where you're like, well, yes, mortgage rates are high now, but where they were a few years ago, it was an unsustainably low level, right? And even compared to historic trends, mortgage rates now are not as high as they were even in the 80s, for example. And so I always tell my students, always try to look at any kind of economic news that you hear within context, because to be honest, it is very easy to take any kind of data point and frame it in a way to fit a certain agenda. And so you always have to be careful of what, even if you trust the source, always think about what is the context of this number that I'm hearing. What is so for example, inflation is 3.1% now. What does that mean compared to where it was, say, 2 years ago? And so that's one of the things that I always tell my students, and I'll tell anyone, always just be mindful of the kind of information that you're hearing and what context does it exist in.
Nancy, thanks a lot for that call. Kevin, in our last minute, there were predictions or assessments that we had a really good chance of going into a recession in 2023, depending on which economist you asked, but it seemed like that risk was there. Not so far. That can change, of course. But briefly, why do you think that hasn't happened, at least not yet?
I think what happened is that many economists assumed that as the Federal Reserve started to raise the interest rates, people spending and just the overall economy would just enter a downward spiral. What ended up happening is that the Federal Reserve raised interest rates and people kept on spending. And part of that is because of pandemic era savings. Part of that was also the fact that the Biden administration passed some pretty big bills. Bipartisan Infrastructure Bill, Inflation Reduction Act, CHIPS and Science Act. So those federal government also played a role in trying to stabilize the economy. And then the Federal Reserve in general was pretty clear about its strategy of raising interest rates. It didn't jump interest rates too quickly. It did it in a gradual way, allowing the economy to adjust. So I think it's really the fact that consumer spending has really held together that has really stopped the economy from going into a recession.
Kevin, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
That's Kevin Smith, assistant professor of economics at Beloit College. He talked to us about the current state of the economy after President Biden's visit yesterday to Milwaukee. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Colorado's Supreme Court says Donald Trump can't be on the ballot in that state for violating a 14th Amendment insurgency clause. Other states may follow, and the U.S. Supreme Court is probably going to weigh in. We'll dig into the legal arguments there, and you can join in with your thoughts. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.